You're listening to the Poetry of Impact podcast, sharing untold stories at the intersection of wealth, wisdom, and well-being with your host, Gino Borges.
I've grappled with my relationship to media consumption. I bet you have too. Maybe you relate to the experience I call digital apnea. Sometimes I'll be at my computer watching a basketball game on YouTube, then toggling to a New York Times article or a news app on my phone at the commercial break. And all of a sudden, I realize I've stopped breathing. Versus if I step out of my office and lie down on the grass in the sunshine, life feels coherent and peaceful. The amount of content available can feel overwhelming, and we may question the ways our emotions are being manipulated for commercial purposes. Yet, as a former filmmaker myself, and as an impact investor, I know that media has the power to shift our perspectives and our behaviors in positive ways. That's why I was excited to invite Elliot Kotek and Jarrett Ruga, two award-winning filmmakers, onto the Poetry of Impact podcast. Elliot is the founder and CEO of The Nation of Artists, and Jarrett is the founder and CEO of Avani Productions. They both know firsthand that film is a powerful culture-building tool that amplifies voices and leverages storytelling for a cause. Our conversation touched on the evolving role of media, from new business models driven by the streaming revolution to how AI will impact content creation and consumption. We dove into what media means at both a commercial and a philosophical level, and how content can change form without losing its depth or impact. If you create content or care about the quality of digital content you consume, this conversation will inspire hope and also give you some practical questions to ask yourself about what you see as the purpose and responsibility of media. So drop in and join me in the conversation with Jarrett Ruga and Elliot Kotek. Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us again. We have two special guests here, Jarrett and Elliot. Really appreciate you guys taking the time to get together. My, oh my, it's been about 6 months to try to get us organized, but offline, I already know you guys have a lot of special stuff to share. You guys are obviously dialed in film and media. Look forward to hearing your thoughts on that, in particular, how you are in relationship to all this change that's going on. Our viewers probably don't know about all this change. We just kind of consume our media without understanding all the industry and how the infrastructure is set up. And we definitely don't know all the people that are behind it and the relationship to that change. And so would love to explore what is being perceived as kind of a chaotic moment right now in the space. And that may be in the eye of the beholder, right? In one respect, Jarrett, you were talking about the chaos. In another respect, Elliot was talking about kind of like there's a sense of thinning or distilling that's happening that's also peaceful and has its own path. So if you don't mind, share a little bit about what you think is going on. And also particularly what's more valuable, I think, is in your relationship with what's going on and how it's impacting you personally and the people that are dependent on you and that you're working with.
Yeah, I can kick us off. I mean, to give a little additional context, you know, to what's happening, basically, we're seeing the end of a gold rush where streaming was positioned as this kind of gold mine in the entertainment industry, the golden era of content where all kinds of niche and high production value properties could be greenlit and distributed and algorithmically recommended. And now everyone has their own personalized menu of content that they can consume every day. And it's unlimited. And there's this walled garden of anything you could ever need in each of the streaming services. And for the consumer, that was positioned to be really great, right? Like you can watch whatever you want, whenever you want, how much of it as you want. And like it's the ultimate pinnacle of consumer choice in media and entertainment. And what was required to create that kind of environment was valuing media companies at tech company, you know, rates. And that was an unsustainable phenomenon, because the multiples that you can get from people paying 8 or 12 or 20 bucks a month for their streaming subscription are not what you would get in a, you know, tech company that can scale to billions without much marginal cost. There's huge marginal cost. Every show you make on Netflix or one of the other streamers is very expensive to produce. And so you'd have to get a lot more subscribers to justify each one of those things. And so that's where the math kind of stopped mathing in the entertainment industry. And so now we're seeing this period of sobering up, of contraction, where there's a lot of consolidation happening. We're seeing some century-old stalwarts like Paramount up for sale. We're seeing some of the smaller niche but still very integrated and well-respected players like Participant close their doors. And individuals are struggling with, you know, individual producers, smaller production companies like mine, kind of struggling with what does that mean for what we produce? Because I know Elliot has also taken this approach, will always make content that's entertaining. First, you have to get an audience. You need eyeballs on your product or what are you doing with your life. But while you have people's attention, I think you have a moral obligation to advance the civil discourse, advance the conversation culturally in a productive way, and to lift people up and not perpetuate negative stereotypes. You know, because it takes a lot of time and money and effort to create any of these properties, and it takes even more effort to get them in front of people. And if you don't seize that opportunity to make the world a little bit better of a place, then I think you're kind of missing the point. And fortunately, there are quite a few people in the industry that agree with that perspective. But I worry in this period of paring down, of consolidation, is that going to go? Are people going to kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, look, we need to just go for things that are reliably profitable and popular, all the franchise stuff, the superhero movies, the, you know, all the stuff that makes good money, but is also very expensive to produce. And so the margin is actually not that great on those big franchise tentpoles. Where you make a ton of money in entertainment is when you have a sleeper hit that was an independent film that was made for, you know, a few hundred thousand or a couple million, and it goes to gross $100 million at the box office, right? Like, that's where the real authentic storytelling meets the commercial market in a way that is highly profitable. And we're seeing a reticence, kind of a nervousness about supporting those types of projects because people want a sure bet. In this period of contraction, they don't want to take what they see as unnecessary risks. Those green lighting decisions become more political than creative. And so I just worry that in this phase of contraction, are we going to lose people's commitment to lifting up stories and storytellers that maybe aren't such a safe bet? And I hope that we can preserve that. And I'm doing what I can, and I know Elliot's doing what he can to keep that front and center, because that's a really easy thing to cut when you have to cut your budget.
Yeah, so much of what you said there, Jared, resonated, and also so many good points in there. The math stopped mathing, right? But I think, like, to that extent, and not to be negative about algorithms, but algorithms started more algorithming. So as these streamers, which were nascent and which needed to have the appearance of being a destination with a wealth of content that covered across a breadth of different types of experiences. So as all these different traditional media companies like Disney, like NBC Peacock, all launched their own pluses, right? Their Disney pluses and HBO Maxes and Apple pluses, like everyone, it's like, oh, we're getting all these bonuses. Everything's additive. Everything's so great. Everything's being maximized. Like, the language was so funny and so fun. But they needed to have a lot of content very, very quickly in order to put up the appearance that they could compete with the early people out of the gate, right? Like Netflix. And so in a rush to do that, the algorithms really weren't an issue. It was more like, who's creating premium content? Who are the good storytellers across various platforms, across various assets, across various genres? And let's get them all in here. And at least then we've got this cache of content that has the ability to start performing. And as the math stopped mathing and the algorithms started algorithming, it became pretty clear that issue-based documentaries were perhaps not the golden child of the streaming statistics, right? That documentaries that were more related specifically to following musicians or a musician's journey, that covered the biographies of people who were known and had audiences, that content that was more related to what even is popular in terms of reality TV. So like more things like true crime, things that were a little perhaps sensationalized. Those were the things that were rising to the top of the charts in terms of viewer numbers. And so you've seen a drop off in the last couple of years of the investment that those same streamers have made in long form documentaries. Now, I'm someone who's asset agnostic. We produce content that ranges from 15-second YouTube pre-roll videos that have the ability to have impact or drive people towards a certain action, all the way through to commercials and anthems, and then on to short and feature documentaries. And what I've found to be just as interesting as what's happening in the studio space that Jared was talking about is also what was happening in the digital media landscape. Companies like Vice, which was seen as the destination for content aimed at young males, they tried to broaden their horizon to other demographics, but that's what they were seen to be for a long time. And a lot of money flowed into them for that demographic, just as it flowed into Refinery 29 for a more female identifying audience. And then we had, you know, BuzzFeed for all the lists and recipes and other things that were the precursors to what we're seeing on TikTok and other media formats. And the reality is that none of those were really, I mean, from what it seems, is none of those were really ever very profitable, if profitable at all. But a lot of VC money came in and floated those for a while. And that just wasn't sustainable as a business proposition. So as the market contracted over the last couple of years, and we saw this kind of coming down off of COVID and the market and inflation and the market subside a little bit, people were more demanding of businesses that showed actual sound businessy stuff underneath, right? And so we're seeing a change in what people are investing in because they need to prove their models. They need to show that people are watching. And so it's been really interesting to watch the contraction across that. But I think it's also a maturation, right? That these entities, even though they were new, are maturing. And they're also recognizing that the landscape has changed in terms of how we consume content. We're consuming content in so many different ways on so many different devices with whatever time we have available to us. And the reality is that next gen, new gen, early adopters across gens are all consuming content on YouTube and other places when they weren't before. It used to be such a singular channel of how we got our content. And now that is unlimited. And so there has to be a reshuffling of the deck in terms of the concentration of our eyeballs that go to one thing or another. And so it has to be a special experience, and it doesn't matter what format it takes, but it has to be a special experience or something that really engages us, whether that's through humor or drama, that really can deliver numbers on any platform. And it doesn't matter whether we pay for it or not, as long as we feel like we've had a good experience.
You know, what's unique is that I think in our community, in the Nexus community, Jared and Elliot, you guys are both known for as content guys, but you guys are, I think people will be surprised how astute you guys are in terms of understanding the business aspects of what goes on.
Is that a backhanded compliment, Jared? What
is that? We thought you guys were just a bunch of dumb creatives with finger paint.
Well, you're making stuff that looked pretty, but there's actually
exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you, Jingle, well, question mark?
Well, I have a ton of questions, but I really want to touch on, Jared used the term worried, and I want to know, what are you doing or not doing to actually deal with that kind of existential reality for yourself about this change is inducing worry in you? And Elliot, I don't know what kind of emotion it's bringing up for you, but I would like to hear you as well so you can contemplate that as well in terms of what it's bringing up for you. So Jared, maybe begin with you and how you're kind of in conversation with your own worry.
Yeah. My baseline kind of temperament is rather anxious to start with. So anytime you throw a chaotic environment or big industry shifts in my line of work, that's going to aggravate the baseline. I mean, I would say like how I'm dealing with that. Elliot mentioned that he is pretty format agnostic. You know, he'll do anything from 15 seconds to 100 minutes. And we were the opposite. We just did feature length documentaries for the first several years of my production company's existence. And what that meant is we were a little bit vulnerable through that focus to the vicissitudes of the market that Elliot touched on with social issue documentaries kind of falling out of favor. I mean, really, you talk to people who are in content acquisition positions for documentary, and there are four categories that are selling right now. It's not social issue, unfortunately. It's true crime, it's sports, it's celebrity driven, and music. Like, if you're one of those four, you can probably sell a pitch right now. If you're not, then it requires a little bit of an act of God for you to sell something. And so we're pivoting a little bit of our documentary focus. We do have our first ever celebrity-driven project that we've started working on, but I can't do fluff. It's not in my constitution. I would not be able to stand behind that kind of work. And so we're making it about democracy and about celebrity activism and how that all interplays with the 2024 presidential election and whether that'll move the needle and should it. What are the kind of normative considerations around what kind of voice should we give these unelected experts who have a lot of influence and sway in the conversation? And so, yes, that will feature the celebrities that are involved in stumping for candidates and getting out the vote, but we'll also do a bit of a deep dive into where did this whole celebrity activism tack come from and where should it go now? How does it play in society? You know, so that's one kind of content-based pivot. And then from a format perspective, we've also got some scripted projects that we spent the last few years developing. First couple of those are now ready to take out and do the whole roadshow where you, what we call attaching talent in the business. You go find actors and director and maybe some executive producers who all like the project enough to put their name on it. And then you can go sell it or raise the money to produce it independently. And that's a bit of a long road as well. So I would say, like, I have compensated for the worry by recognizing that I need to be nimble and I need to kind of roll with what the market is asking for. But I also can't sacrifice the creative or artistic integrity, because no project that panders tends to do well. Audiences can read that inauthenticity. And so I have to stay true to the kind of content I would want to produce, but just align it a little more closely with what the market's buying right now.
And if Jared goes down the anxious route, I tend to choose a sense of optimistic urgency in terms of how we approach work. I have such a degree of urgency around so many issues. And we used to think that maybe that there were issues that myself and my team were not maybe inside of, that perhaps we should leave alone. But I think the way that we've been able to identify a plan for our content and ecosystems and other buzzwords around our content and the content that we produce means that people from all sorts of issues have come to work with us over time. And so we've made and helped make things about grassroots innovation, about people who don't have a traditional education, who are solving global issues, but on a very local scale. We've made documentaries and helped make documentaries like Little Miss Sumo, which is a gender parity issue for a woman in Japan whose national sport of sumo wrestling doesn't permit professional females. So you've got half the country forbidden from performing their national sport, which is ludicrous. Well, that project, we've worked on projects like Black Boys and Black Girls, which is social justice and education inequity issues, and found a path to play and a role to play on those. We've worked on Unzipped around the housing affordability crisis and tackled those issues. And it's been really interesting to be kind of inside of those urgent social issues while at the same time working out pathways to take advantage of what we're seeing and things like Jared is identifying. Like, how do you incorporate some aspect of celebrity in there that is, you know, to use an overused term, that is organic or sincere, that is meaningful in some ways, that is enabling the content to reach a different demographic? What extra content do you produce? Like, if you are producing a feature documentary, we kind of have a saying, or I have a saying, that documentaries are for people who watch documentaries, which is its own limiting audience, right? And so on some of our projects, we might have the documentary itself, but then we'll have little story stretches, or like little 15-minute clips or little 6-minute clips or other pieces that go out on different channels, that if people consume those, then they're consuming the issue without consuming the documentary. And that's okay. And you have to be okay with it too. But what it requires of you as a content creator may mean that you're wearing more hats than what a documentary filmmaker would ordinarily wear, that you're more aware of bringing in other partners, that you're okay with bringing in brands who believe in the issue too. And brands have a huge role to play in this world, because they're also looking for that meaningful connection and to build those assets that they can get behind that stand for their purpose and their quote unquote why, in addition to the stuff that they're making on the marketing side, right? And so we've been really, and what something I've been excited about doing recently over the last couple of years is getting out there and sharing some of that. Like, we have a few different tools that we use. One is called internal, external, eternal, for how we package something for impact. And that's broken down into another thing called the 6 A's, which range from aim at, like, what's your overall aim? How do you create awareness? Do you want to create awareness, or do you want to actually seek behavioral change, or do you want to challenge legislation, or like, what do you want to actually achieve by your aim? Like, who are your allies in that? What are the assets you're going to provide to those people to make their lives easy, to be able to help? What's your ask? How are you going to dial that in? Once you've made it, who are the ambassadors that are going to help you amplify it? And what's your ambition? Right? So all these things that are really, like, if you work through them, you can put yourself in a much better spot. You can de-risk some of the things that a lot of documentary filmmakers are just kind of taking on themselves by just kind of pressing go on the camera, because that's a setting, apparently, on the camera, the go setting. Like, just starting to record and then trying to figure out everything else later. But, like, yeah, there's definitely ways to do it.
Elliot, do you feel like you're on to something as, like, a business model, like, matching up, like, in a certain amount of, like, this emotional disposition that you claim to be predisposed to, this optimistic urgency? Is it because you really see that, or you tell yourself it's like, it could be one of two things? Like, you know what? It doesn't do me any good, I've realized in my short life, to think it's like, oh, it's all going to shit. It's like, I don't want to get up. Or I can just take this idea, even if I don't even know where in the hell it's going, I might as well be optimistic. Or do you really see that? I mean, or is it somewhere like, for instance, if you weren't doing film, would optimistic urgency be if you were running the top plumbing company in Los Angeles and servicing people's plumbing needs? I mean, is that Elliot as far?
We're going to get down some really gnarly passageways to kind of,
yeah, to keep. Because I'm really interested in, like, who's serving who. Like, I mean, is the channel serving your disposition, or are you serving the channel, or is it, I'm just trying to figure out.
It's weird to talk about yourself in this way, but, like, I've never had a downtime mode. You know, like, everyone used to joke, like, what are you doing with your downtime? Like, it was like, because they knew I, even when I worked in an office many, many years ago, that I always had multiple side projects on the go. I always had that sense of urgency. I always had the ability to, of not needing to sleep much. And that was just a huge asset for me, because I always had that. So for me, even when I was a journalist, I would tell people, hey, if you're pitching an outlet, go and download the advertising PDF that's on the website, because the advertising PDF will tell you what issues are coming out, because they're trying to sell advertising into it, but you can use it to pitch editorial. Like, I was always finding these ways to amplify voices. And so for me, it's just a logical extension. It's just, it's what I've always done. I don't know any other mode. And so for me, it was like everything I've done has not been because I made necessarily a decision to go into that path. It's just a series of yeses, things that I thought were cool and people I wanted to help or stories I wanted to tell that took me down a certain path. I didn't intend to do any of this, quite frankly. And, you know, if you look back at what I first studied at school, it was really had nothing to do with any of this. It was really just things I was curious about, and I can't underestimate the power of curiosity, but things I was curious about coupled with a sense of discipline around them, right? So we have a saying, our company's main motto is ideas plus empathy equals impact. We think that you can have all the ideas in the world, but if you don't apply them in a way that is relevant to the community you're serving, then you're not going to have the impact you need. And likewise, you can have all the empathy in the world, but at some point, you have to move beyond just the feels and just the presence with that community or with that person and put some ideas behind it so you can move forward toward impact, right? And so I think that's always been a very constitutional thing for me, is just to have that makeup and to want to move it forward, to solve it in some way or to augment it in some way or amplify it in some way toward a result or toward a path of impact.
It reminds me of the old saw about anxiety and excitement are physiologically identical. And the emotion you experience is the story you layer on top of that. Yeah, I think Elliot's approach is better. Let's be excited, not anxious.
You know what's cool, Gino? It's like when you see what having a sense of purpose, it doesn't, and like what a sense of purpose gives you. And like a sense of purpose doesn't need to be this carefully, beautifully crafted workshop thing. It's not something that's only accessible to people who have extra time or extra resources on their hands. That just knowing what you're about helps you make decisions more clearly all the time. And when you think about it, even in a corporate setting, it's like your sense of purpose of why you're doing something, it can define your culture, right? And it can really like also change the resiliency of a corporation or a group of people, because if they all know what direction they're going in, then they know how to make those decisions along the way that keep them purposeful, that keep them going toward that goal. And so whether you look at it in terms of culture or resilience or your vision and alignment or the agility of a company or the engagement that you get out of your stakeholders, it's all very easily directed if everyone knows what direction they're rowing in, right? If they have a common purpose related to it. And that can be to make good content or to have an incredible impact from making that content. And I think you don't need everyone to have the same reason to be there, but they need to come together to help achieve that goal.
Guys, I really want to touch on this idea of we just assume we know what media is and media means. And, you know, I spent a fair amount of my PhD program studying the philosophy of media and Neil Postman and Marshall McLuhan. And when all of a sudden you start reading the postmodernists and Derrida and you start realizing like, shit, this whole media thing is, it's way too assumed. Like it's a monster in some ways if left unreflective to people. So I want to step back and really like, what the hell is this phenomena that is seemingly representing life to us or representing a story to us that's taken what we used to share by the fire and now all of a sudden is in these digital pixels that are transferred to us. And so I would love to get your more of this, like, what the hell is it at its core? And why do you believe in it so much? And then more importantly, what is its limitations as well as you're working through it? I realize this benefit, it's all been beautiful, but there's also a certain shortcoming and this is where the limitations begin.
I studied both communication and philosophy in undergrad. And so I have some thoughts. I mean, the kind of academic definition of media is any mediated communication, right? So something that separates one person from hearing another directly. And that could be a newspaper, that could be a painting, that could be a film, that could be a song, anything that is communication or expression that is separated in space and time. I mean, technically, even a phone call would meet the mediated communication definition. I don't think we would call a phone call media. But yeah, it's anytime there's something that intervenes between the message being created by the speaker and received by the audience, that's media. And what happens in that gap can either be wonderful and artistic and expressive and generative, or it can be kind of terrifying and authoritarian and oppressive and scary. Most fortunately fall somewhere in between those two poles. But really, like, media is a kind of mass consumable artistic form of communication that allows a few people to reach an audience of many. And I think, like, the promise of social media was democratizing that access, giving anyone who is willing to kind of game the algorithms and produce that content every day, any of those can have the same reach that a multi-billion dollar film studio could have with its big marketing budget. And what we found is that the people who were able to consolidate audiences in the tens of millions and more were essentially playing on the same forces that made the existing players successful. And so what was kind of couched as this democratizing tool ended up just being the same kind of consolidation of power that you see across other media. And the gatekeeper, instead of being a human being making a creative choice at a studio or a TV network, was the algorithm. We kind of offloaded that responsibility to tech. So anyway, I think that's fascinating. I think, to me, why media matters is because it's the closest thing we have to mass real-time culture building. And it creates touchstones for us to meet and convene and talk about the same things and get to know each other through topics that maybe we wouldn't feel comfortable speaking about directly with our family and friends. And it's also this incredibly complex art form where, if you want to tell the truth, do so through fiction, right? Like, you hear that from time to time, where stories that are incredibly specific to one protagonist, one main character, can feel incredibly universal to a broad audience because ultimately they're keying into some deeply resonant facet of the human experience. And with film in particular, the thing that I like so much about that, that's also a little bit frustrating from time to time, is it's so simple to watch, so simple to consume. You just sit on a couch or anywhere and you've got a screen in front of you, whether it's a TV or a phone, it's a piece of cake to consume it. It is so damn hard to make it. And it requires so many people. That kind of paradox of something being so easy to consume, but so hard to make, really speaks to me as a personal and professional challenge. And it's so collaborative. Like, filmmaking requires any film, even a low budget independent documentary film, requires 100 people to touch the project, or, you know, from its whole life cycle just to get it to market. And if you're on a big budget studio film, it's hundreds or thousands of people touch that film. And everyone leaves their fingerprints on it in one way or another. And so I do feel like that is one of the few ways to truly collaborate creatively and do it at scale where millions of people can see it.
That was so eloquent, Jared. It makes me always, when someone is that eloquent, makes me want to respond with something totally pithy.
Like, yeah, please summarize what I just pontificated for 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
Just, like, give us the sound
bite. I would summarize it with, like, Jared wants to put the me in media.
Like, there you go. I love it.
Amazing.
Or opposite, to make myself look dumb and go, there's no I in media. Oh, yeah, there is. There's a
Yeah.
I think you're right, Jared. Like, I mean, obviously, you're like, it's a salient point. And the reality is it's a shared experience, right, that we can talk about, that we can, but it's also an isolated individual experience. We can each check in on something and have a relationship to it and have a reaction to it. And whether we share it or not is up to us. And so it's incredibly versatile in that way. And I mean, you know, I'm not a philosophy major, so I'm not going to start quoting Derrida or Sartre or any of your folks, but I come from, yeah, I mean, a culture of storytelling, though, right? And that is as old as time and overused as a phrase, and calling people storytellers is so ugh, right? Like, it's so gross and overused, but because it is so accessible, because it is so universal, that oftentimes what is perceived to be the work of media is something that everyone assumes that they, had that given the time, would be able to do. It's a really incredible thing when you work in a business that doesn't seem to have any barriers to entry, unlike some sort of professional services, right? Like, where years of study are needed for something particular, because there are so many pathways to get here, right? Like Jared saying, he studied it, he went through school for it. I came to it later and then I was doing it already when I went to school for it, just in case, you know, my feeling was like, just in case I've missed out on something that I need. But the reality is that you can come at it in different ways. And it's really, to doing it can either take someone who's extremely ambitious and talented in all things, or an extreme number of collaborators. There are individual operators. I have a friend, Miguel, in Cuba, who, like Clint Eastwood, like in some ways, right? Who directs, writes, does the music and the score, edits, you know, this guy makes the graphics as well. It's like, it's incredible how much you can do if you have the time and the energy. But that notion of collaboration around media is where I find power, right? Because I draw energy from collaborating with people. Like, if I think about what my purpose is, it's about unifying creativity and collaboration for impact, right? Like, bringing creativity to a group where everyone plays a different role to bringing that media to fruition. And I think that's what's exciting about it. But I do think that, kind of a little bit contrary to what Jared was saying around the gatekeepers tend to keep coming through in each iteration of what media presents, I think the reality is that there's no gatekeeper to doing good content and finding an audience. The gatekeeping comes in the commercialization of it, how people make money from it. And I think that that's to make real money from it, like life-changing, community-changing money from it. And I think that there is a difference in media, and maybe the word media usually applies to the business side of it, right? And so it's the commercialization of it that traditionally has these gatekeepers who either do it by design or by acquisition. And we saw it early on with Microsoft buying up whatever the small innovative group was that came next. We saw it with Google and Google X buying technologies and robotics companies and other things. And that's just the nature of the beast, is that in order to maintain relevance, you either have to innovate from within or acquire that innovation. Certainly, if you have those cash deposits on hand, like an Apple or a Meta, et cetera, then you can go about that business pretty easily. But there's this disruption happening all the time. And some people can choose to maintain an independent path, like what happened with Snap from the get-go, or like what happened with Zuckerberg. You know, no matter what we think of these individuals, they held on to control of their destiny for a very long time. And so it really takes a will that is extraordinary to defy just being consumed by a larger entity. And I think that that's just a common business proposition, regardless of the industry. But for me, the word media connotes a commercialization of it that tends to be controlled by the few. And it's becoming more and more open, but the real money, the concentration of money, the concentration of capital, tends to be passed around between some traditional players, for sure.
I would concur with that important distinction, that nuance there. I also wanted to key off of something you mentioned earlier, Elliot, about storytelling and how that's kind of an overbroad moniker that gets applied to situations where it may not be appropriate. And while I agree, I think it's kind of an irritating term because like everyone's a storyteller now. But ultimately, when you think about it, if you're using kind of the core definition of storyteller, like, yeah, everyone is a storyteller because storytelling is the operating system of the human mind, right? Like that's how we make sense of the world. When you look at extraordinary feats of like memory, for example, and the tax people use to create memory palaces so that they can remember sequences of numbers and facts that like seem impossible. They do that by making themselves a protagonist in a story that they walk through in their mind visually, right? And that's like a hack to memory. So it's pretty clear to me that everyone is conversant with storytelling, even if they're not a professional storyteller. But it also is kind of shocking, given that it's the operating system of our mind and the basis of all of our social relationships, how few people actually know how to cut through all the noise and create a strong signal that resonates and amplifies and hits a large audience. Because it is like, I look at when we started developing our scripted content, I read hundreds of scripts and hated 99% of them. And you know, part of that was personal taste, but part of it was also like some of them were just objectively bad. And it's like, how are some people so good at keying into that emotional cadence and empathizing with the protagonist and through that emotional experience with someone and really transporting yourself into that story and you're just gripped by it? And others have no sense of awareness of how to do that. They lack that skill. It's all storytelling. It's just degrees of expertise in pulling it off artfully and effectively.
Yeah. And it's not limited by expression either. It could be a series of images only. It could be a series of words only. It could be a series of sounds only. It could be any combination of those. And I think that's where the joy of it is that recognizing that the power of that effect that media can have, that project can have, that film can have, that music can have, right, is so powerful if done in a way that is resonant. And what's incredible too is like, it really depends on your objectives. Some people just do it to please themselves, some to please a few, some to please or to engage with a very small committed audience, and some to try and do things at mass commercialization to appeal to as many people from as many places as possible at the same time. And so knowing where you stand in that chain is so important, because that's where disappointment comes, right? It's like if you're trying to do everything for everyone but only reaching a few, then you're extremely disappointed. But if you're only trying to reach those few and have meaningful engagement and you do reach those people, then you have a much higher hit rate and can feel incredibly proud and appreciated and part of something in a way that is so rewarding. And so knowing that of yourself and seeking a level of feedback that is, I don't want to say appropriate, but like that is in keeping with what your objectives are, I think is part of the battle for a lot of people. Because I think a number of people, certainly in the documentary space, set out to make a documentary that they hope will change hearts and minds. But if it's not being shown to people whose hearts and minds are open to that change, then the vehicle has to be questioned through which you are utilizing to try and seek that change. And so you're much more likely to be disappointed. And so choosing the right vessel and thinking about what the audience is and what your aims are before you set out to make the content, I think is such a rewarding experience, because it can really help you match what you're trying to achieve with the projects that you actually get behind and invest your time and money and energy and resources into.
Do you guys think that, and we'll be rounding out our conversation here a little bit, but do you think that we're at an evolutionary mismatch as a consumer versus the exponentiality of the media, specifically both the way Jared talked about media and the way Elliot talked about media, all of these forces kind of coming together? And then here's the lone sentient being behind his screen, his or her screen, and it's all coming at me. And I have a shitload of tabs open. I got the New York Times open. I got my YouTube TV. When the Laker games took a commercial break, I clicked to the New York Times. I'm reading some articles and I click back. am I just kind of just shitting on myself to some extent, like my emotional well-being? I'm intentionally volunteering for a shit show, because when I walk out and disintermediate from this whole world, I'm a happy clam. I mean, I'm walking through the park. I got my backyard here. I walk barefoot in the sun. No problems. But here I stop breathing. My breathing, I got like, you know, digital apnea where you just like stop breathing at the computer. it's like, what the hell am I doing to myself? Is there something going on here at an evolutionary level? It's like, holy shit, we're just exposing people to way too much goddamn stimuli. And maybe there is like other outcomes besides social activism, justice, awareness, that at a biochemistry, existential, spiritual level, maybe some compensation going on. I don't know. I'm just like, do you guys see it on that end?
Yeah, I mean, the digital apnea is a really nice analogy for it. But, you know, it really depends who you are and what you're looking to experience, right? Now, like part of you really wants to know what's happening in that Lakers game.
True.
You get joy True. From seeing those skilled athletes performing at that level, which is incredible.
Absolutely.
It's a spectacle. It's what we used to go to a Coliseum for, right? It's entertainment and artistry and athleticism. And that's why we tune in to that or Caitlin Clark or anything else that bears witness to incredible feats of human nature. And so you're experiencing human nature when you're looking at that, just as you're experiencing nature when you walk outside. Now, they have different relationships to your physical being and cause you different levels of either excitement or relaxation. But some people get the opposite, right? Some people from an urban setting get anxious when they go out in nature because they don't hear the familiar sounds of the trucks going by and the sounds of the city in which they feel comfortable, where quiet suggests or connotes that something is wrong, right? I remember when I first moved to LA from New York at night, it was too quiet. I was scared, like there was something wrong, because in New York, if you're walking down a street and it's totally silent, you're really heightened that something is up, right? So it's an interesting thing about what we seek and what you do as a seeker. Now, that is not to say that the companies that present the media aren't trying to manipulate you and aren't trying to keep you engaged. Obviously, there's all these amazing documentaries like The Social Dilemma by Jeff Orlowski and others that are talking about how we are being corrupted away from our natural selves. But if we give ourselves the agency, if we recognize that, then we might be, and often are, and it's not limited by class or access, we're just as excited a lot of times to be watching a Love Island or a Bachelorette as we are some piece of highbrow content or things that we think of as traditionally highbrow in the New York Times. And it comes back to a question of awareness of that manipulation, right? Now, should there be some level setting? I think, again, it's a maturation of the business, right? We're seeing tech companies called before Congress to give answers for this. AI is just going to accelerate it to another level because we're going to have so much content that is produced so quickly and without filter by these digital agents that we are just going to continue to be bombarded by more and more quote unquote noise. And so then what happens, right? And what happens to people when they reach that limit of what they can bear? Do we then switch off? There's ironically a lot of media being given to the boring phone, to Alpha Gen, wanting to have phones that don't have social media on them. That is a natural progression of when things become any level of extreme, is that we want to go against the grain. We do it to our parents. Our parents are heavy metal artists. Maybe we like classical. If they like lots of classical, maybe we go heavy rock, right? Like there's a native tendency, an innate tendency to rebel against the previous generation. And then there's also an instinctual nature of when things become extreme, wanting to turn them off. And so for those of us with that agency and awareness, and hopefully more people get the tools, or there's a level setting that it's assumed that you get the tools to start with and you can turn on what you want, as opposed to being burdened with having to turn it off, But as we mature with what social media is, because it has not been a long time in terms of numbers of years that we've had this level of energy coming at us, but as it becomes more pronounced and as these protective measures come into play, we'll be able to choose what to lean into versus being forced to turn off what we need to lean out of.
I have nothing to add. That was that perfectly all encapsulated. Right. Although I will say the AI revolution and explosion, right, which we're just on the precipice of, like we're about to see that in the next few years, that is going to flood the market with so much noise that the human signal will have to come through. I think people will opt out of AI content and will have some way of filtering that and only doing authenticated human produced because it will overwhelm the system. So when people say, is AI the end of media? No, because it requires so much consumption by an audience that is ultimately not going to trust it, that I think I'm making the call now. I think humans will continue to work in media. We're not going to be replaced by robots.
And just to refine also what you're saying, Jared, is that even if it's authenticated, we won't trust it as authentication. We'll assume a bot has authenticated it. So the curiosity for me comes back into what always, like I ran magazines and other digital platforms for a while. And the power of that is the power of curation, right? It's like taking all the noise, filtering stuff out, and then presenting what you hope people will respond to. And so as the noise becomes noisier, then we will seek, I assume, more and more direct human connection, direct local human interaction. And that's where these kind of 15-minute city models are really interesting. It's like, who will we surround ourselves with and with what sense of immediacy or proximity do we need to have to them in order to feel like we have a meaningful day-to-day that is probably more offline than online? Right. And so who are we getting our content from? Who are we getting our analysis from? Where do they live? How are they in our orbit? Are we having dinner parties with them? Are we having work conversations with them? Are we just meeting them as we collide with each other on the street? And then it also begs the question of, do we then live in urban or rural environments? Because the people who live in rural environments won't have that many interactions by comparison, and they'll potentially, if they're seeking it, be forced more into an online world. And so again, we'll have these disparities of who has what and who leans into what by virtue of where we happen to be born into or the ability we have to travel out of it.
Wow, this is amazing. I could talk to you guys for hours. It feels like you guys are just getting on a roll. But I do want people to be able to find and learn more about the work that you guys are doing in the world, Jared and Elliot. Thank you so much. Super thoughtful. We're almost an hour into this, and I feel like I can really listen to your guys' philosophy, and just I'm really impressed on how you guys nuance everything and see everything in conversation with everything else, whether it's the business with the content with the business, yourself relative to the business, yourself relative to the content. And so I found it very illuminating at a lot of levels. And so I definitely want to share your work with others. And so where could people learn a little bit more about your work?
My production company is called Vavani, V-A-V-A-N-I. So you can do a Google search for that or my name and stuff will come up.
Yeah, likewise, you can lean into me on LinkedIn. And then we're actually going through the process. We were kind of happily going with a if you know platform for our production company for a long time. So our production company is called The Nation of Artists. And we didn't have a website for the last decade. And so we're actually in the process now of building something new, but really just because we want to share some of these tools that we hope people can then go off and use without having to kind of contract us to do it. So we're kind of encapsulating some of our rules and equations and things like that into the platform. And we're also just sharing a handful of projects rather than a mass of projects so that we can get into the case studies behind them. So I look forward to sharing that shortly.
Sounds great. And if you missed anything, we'll have everything in the show notes as well, including a lot of the key references that were made during the conversation. So with that, thank you, Jared. Thank you, Elliot.
Appreciate you, Gino. Thanks,
thank
Jared.
Thank you for having us. Yeah, this was fun.
Always good hearing your sexy radio voice.
Really? I actually didn't know I had one, but I'll take it.
I was saying Jared, but Gino's still.
Oh, Jared. That, That's a zinger to get back at you for our finger painting earlier.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I get it. I get it.
Thank you both.
Hey, everyone. Thanks again for listening in to today's conversation on the Poetry of Impact. The podcast exists for and because of listeners like you. Be sure to subscribe to the Poetry of Impact podcast on your favorite podcast player. And if you have time, leave us a review. Thanks again and goodbye for now. Till next time.
Thank you for listening to the Poetry of Impact podcast. For show notes and additional resources, visit poetryofimpact.com.